Okay, so we're finally getting into cosmology. So last time I started talking about general relativity, and earlier I described in theories of particle physics how we view the fundamental essence of forces in electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force, to be the exchanges of these strange virtual particles, these gauge bosons. And that mathematical theory works very well. So when people talk about a quantum theory of a force, that's really the kind of thing they mean. There is, I think if you made most physicists vote on it, they would also believe that there is probably a quantum picture of gravitation that should work. There are reasons to believe we have to have it, which is, as you look on smaller and smaller distance scales for gravity, there comes a point where the curvature of the space-time, a la what we're going to talk about, what we've talked about, and then I'll remind you of today, is on the order of the size of the wavelength you would get from de Broglie's formula. So you have no choice but for quantum effects to kick in. So we don't yet actually have a quantum theory of gravity, but we do have a theory of gravity that works on very large scales, and this is it. And it has basically a different mental picture, which I guess could be bothersome, but it's really not unusual to have a different picture of a force at a large scale versus at a small scale. So in electromagnetism, you've already seen it. Coulomb's law works just fine, but if you want to do detailed calculations of particles interacting with one another, you're going to have to use quantum electrodynamics, which is the theory with where you have the exchanges of the particles. So it's not as crazy as it sounds. At any rate, in general theory of relativity, the starting point is the recognition that accelerated reference frames and the gravitational field are basically the same thing. And so anytime you're in something that's accelerating, if it's a car, for example, you get slammed into the back of the seat, or an airplane. I mean, it's as if, can you really tell the difference? Or is the plane accelerating, or does somebody put a big mass back here that's basically accelerating you backwards? So it's you can concoct an example where that is not so obvious an answer, and that one example is if you're in a room. I mean, how do you really know whether that room is still on Earth if it has no windows, or if it's in a rocket ship that's accelerating at 1G, which is exactly the same acceleration a rock would have at the surface of the Earth if you dropped it? So effectively, in each case, what you would perceive is a force of the floor on your feet, which is equivalent to your weight. And what Einstein says is you can't tell the difference. So if you now follow that to its logical conclusion, you actually get the general theory of relativity. And to help make the mental picture stick, I like to look at these the example of here on the accelerated reference frame, where we can mentally see at least what one implication of this would be. If this rocket ship is here and is accelerating upward, and you have a light gun that shoots a pulse of light out, then you can imagine as the pulse travels from the tip of the gun to the side of the wall, this room, this box that's around it, is accelerating upward during that time, which means as the light propagates forward, this box moves up around that light, basically, is a way to think about it. And since the person is attached to the box, the gun is also moving up. And if these are snapshots in time equally spaced, because you're accelerating, for each snapshot you move further. So the difference between these two snapshots should be bigger than the difference between those two snapshots should be bigger than the distance between those two snapshots. So if you think about what this would look like from the point of view of the guy holding the little light gun, it's going to look like the light curves, like so. And I've greatly exaggerated what you would see at 1G, but just to give you a sense. And then Einstein's equivalence principle tells you that gravitation should make light curve. And if light curves and you think light should go in the shortest distance between two points, that's a way of saying, a way of modeling that would be to say that gravity distorts space such that the shortest distance between these two points is curved. In other words, you're working in a geometry where lines are curved. And so Einstein then created the theory of general relativity, where he interpreted the effect of a large mass or a large area of energy, m equals mc squared, so those are equivalent, you know, except for constants within his theory, that what it does to space is literally distorted. And that distortion is the nature of the theory. The mathematics is quite intractable because differential geometry is hard, but it's workable, and it has very particular predictions. And they can be a little bit subtle. So there's one prediction about the orbit of Mercury that's been seen to happen, where Newtonian gravity, for example, is just wrong. And there are effects on light traveling out of strong gravitational fields where the frequency changes. And you can see the curvature of light by looking at the apparent position of stars and how they change as the light goes near the sun. Because as the light goes near the sun, if it curves and you see it over here, you will perceive the light coming from here, but yet it came from over here because it curves as it goes around the sun. And then there are other predictions of general relativity, but these effects are very small. One of them is that changing masses or massively changing energy should actually cause ripples in space-time that propagate outward, which are called gravitational waves. But they're extremely small, and it's really hard to see them, but people are trying, so there are experiments to do it. So that's a bit of a summary about general relativity. Any questions or yes?
I don't know if this is true at all, but like, you know, when it's sunset and the sun is like coming towards the earth and the sun is already set but it's still light up, does that have anything to do with like bending light waves?
Yes, but it's more of a classical physics effect. I mean, just like light bends in a lens because of changes of indices of refraction. So this effect actually happens in a vacuum. The other thing about what's happening in what you're discussing is that the light gets scattered by particles in the atmosphere. So if Earth is here and the sun is coming here, light penetrates up higher in the atmosphere and gets scattered down. And in fact, because that scattering direct, if the light is coming this way, there is more of a probability of, let's see, if the light is coming straight at you, there's more of a probability of the red light being scattered toward you and the blue light being scattered down. So that's why if the sun is over here and it's shining into the deep sky, the sky straight above you, it looks deep blue. But as the sun goes down and you're looking more toward the sun, the scattering preferentially scatters the red light, which is why you get red sunsets. So, I don't know, a little bit of weirdness. But that's all classical stuff. That's not general relativity. That's Maxwell. Okay, so last time I made a little diversion into a multiverse because we had talked about stars and stellar evolution and we were getting to black holes. And so I wanted to at least go through it along with some pictures to help, which I knew I had, so I didn't try to do much with it last time. Anyway, there's a guy, Lee Smolin, who came up with this idea, which when I first heard about it, I thought it sounded completely wacky. But I'm a little less... What is up with those? Sorry, there's some lights I can't seem to control here. Stage lights. Let me try that. Okay. So he starts off by asking what happens in a black hole. And the idea of the black hole is that there comes a stage in the life of a star where the fusion processes that are producing heat that are pushing outward stop, and gravitation basically just starts pulling everything inward and there's nothing left to stop it. And when that happens, basically what is inside the black hole goes toward the center. We say it forms a singularity, that is, everything goes to a point right in the middle. And when that happens, basically you're getting more and more mass in a smaller and smaller region. And if we just think classically for a minute in Newtonian physics, remember that the gravitational field strength drops off as 1 over the distance squared. So if you get more and more mass in a smaller and smaller spot, that means you can come closer and closer. And as you get closer and closer with that much mass there, the 1 over distance squared, is the distance is becoming smaller and smaller, which means that number is getting higher and higher. So the force of gravity in that region is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And eventually it becomes so strong that if you shine a laser light straight up, it won't escape. It actually, and so that's why you call it a black hole. Even light can't escape. So nothing can escape a black hole. And if you now ask what happens inside a black hole, it becomes somewhat of an academic exercise simply because we'll never get into a black hole to see. But there's nothing in this whole multiverse theme that, I mean, we're certainly not going to let that stop us. Yes?
What did you say, the force?
Yeah, it's gravity.
Just gravity? Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so it does in general relativity, right? Because you're interpreting gravity as bending space, literally. So what happens in a black hole is if you get enough gravity in this one area, enough strength, field strength there, it actually bends the space back on itself. So if you were to shoot a ray of light, it can't even get out. That's a way of looking at it. The black hole would look black if you were able to see it. The ones, I mean, literally, if it were just out in space, we'd never, I mean, you wouldn't know it. You could only detect it by its effect on light passing near it, which gets bent. You might see it that way. How we typically have seen black holes is if they are formed in a multiple star system and they literally can pull some of the mass off another star, and as it spirals in, it can give a characteristic, it basically gets ripped apart and can give characteristic signal that people can see, because it gets ripped apart outside of this region. This boundary where the point of no return, people call the event horizon. So you may, I don't know if I'll slip and use that or not, but if I do, that's what I mean. Also, I guess you can call it the Schwarzschild radius, because a guy named Schwarzschild did a lot of calculations like this. At any rate, gravity collapses everything to a point in here, and I say that beasts dwell here because what that means is your equations go wacko, because you can't take everything and put it in a point and not have infinities and things crop up in the equations. So you actually have to have a theory of quantum gravity in order to make that work. And so we don't really know what happens in here because we don't really have a working model, but that doesn't keep physicists from playing. And Lee Smolin, he does actually work in the area, and he may have some reasons to believe he has some idea of what's going on there, but let's not worry about how correct he is in the theory. Let's just play with the idea that he comes up with. And what he says is that if we look at, as a function of time, what's happening inside the black hole, here's our parent universe out here, and here's basically the matter that's inside the black hole. It collapses to a point, which is almost a point, and then due to quantum gravity effects, which who knows what exactly is happening, it basically then starts to re-expand. So there's a bounce, which he claims might happen. And if that happens, then you have expanding space-time here, and I jumped the gun a little bit in starting the Fecund Multiverse because the theme for today is to talk about why we believe in the expanding universe. But if we do believe in it, then the characteristics of this can look very much like the early stages of our universe when it started expanding. And he argues that whatever the physical constants are of the parent universe, the space-time here being the masses of the different particles, the strengths of the forces, and things like that, those will be largely transferred through this bounce, potentially, with only minor adjustments due to quantum effects during the actual bounce. And then you basically have this daughter universe that's born, but it's within this black hole, but you would never know that if you were inside the black hole. Yes? Quite simply, you cannot communicate with anything inside that Schwarzschild radius. I mean, once that black hole is formed, you have totally lost your ability to connect with anything inside there.
But doesn't it still exist? Like, just because we can't, like, we can send stuff into it. So, like, if the universe, like, if it, like, starts collapsing in on itself, and all of a sudden you have, like, this bird of a universe, like, isn't that universe now going to be in our universe? Just like where the black hole looks?
I understand exactly what you're saying, and I'll have to see if I can come up with a nice way of explaining why that's not really the case. It's I mean, it's truly disconnected from then on. So it's sort of, I have seen pictographs of sort of what how you picture the space, and it's easy. Maybe that's a way to see it. Yeah, so, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I just can't, off the top of my head, give you a good answer that will make it warm and fuzzy for you, for me. Yes?
So I have two questions. The first, so the force of the bounce would be greater than the force that basically crushes matter? Like, within the black hole, because it seems like kind of, when everything in the black hole is kind of geared towards, like, crushing things into a single...
Yeah, it's crushed... We're really talking about the. The matter, any matter that was in there is gone. So really what you have is energy in space and time at that point. The space-time bounces, and energy is basically a measure of how the space-time is all twisted and warped. And so what it's a geometrical bounce of the space-time, and when you have the expanding space-time and then you have enough energy bouncing around in there, basically that energy will begin to turn into particles and things like that that you'll see later on. I mean, even at the very small stages, if you believed in quantum gravity, you would say what you have are bunches of gravitons. I mean, you could picture it in the form of gravity, of quantum gravity particles.
Would the subatomic particles be, like, crunched too? Like, they'd be smaller to allow them to, like, exist in the black hole? Or?
Yeah, that's why, I mean, I haven't... You guys have me on very thin ice here. I haven't studied particle physics up at these kinds of scales because it's just outrageously beyond what we can actually do in the lab. I think you'd have a lot of gravitons and particles that we don't normally talk about at that point. I mean, yeah, I'm not so sure that you would have the typical types of particles that we generally talk about. Although, I mean... Yeah, I mean, you have a soup of some sorts of particles if you want to look at it in a particle sort of way. If you want to look at it in more of a space-time sort of way, I think it means things will be very highly distorted in there. Yeah?
So I have two questions. Once in the black hole, does matter move? Like, all, like, electrons are moving around and everyone's bouncing up and down, but in the black hole, do they do that? Like, they stay still?
To the extent they have energy, yeah, they'll be moving within them, if you can imagine particles within there. I mean, the kind of matter that we visualize, I think, is just crushed to nothing. I mean, or to energy. It can't. You have tidal forces in there.
And how fast does it take for apparent universe to become a black hole to the point where it's kind of
balanced? The parent universe doesn't become a black hole. You form black holes within stars in the parent universe.
Right.
Okay, so as I have it drawn right here, it's actually, I should move this somewhere up here or something, so it's deceptive. So it can take a long time to form a black hole in the star, because basically that happens at the end of the star's lifetime. And then you ask, what happens? And maybe this is partly the answer to the question that's bothering some of you. If you ask what is happening at the event horizon from outside the black hole, time appears to stop. So from our point of view, we don't actually see, once things don't actually go into the black hole from our point of view, because time basically stops right at the event horizon. Things get to that point. So that may be a way of thinking about this weird disconnectedness. Not that I know that, not that that really makes it feel more warm and fuzzy to me, but yeah. No, the black hole, I mean, from our universe, it would just always be a black hole there. That energy would still be there distorting the space in our, what we would perceive as our universe. I just think that on the other side, the perception is different. Okay, so these are all great questions, and I'm flailing about to try to answer some of them, but in all honesty, I have to admit that I'm presenting some things where this is not what I do professionally. So I'm not a string theorist, and I don't do quantum gravity. So I can't really give you good answers to some of these great questions. The picture that Smolin paints, the piece I'm certainly more comfortable with, is that if you imagine here's our universe where black holes get formed, and within the black holes you have other universes formed, and within them you can form black holes. Basically, if the characteristics of the daughter universes are fairly similar to the one that begat them, if you want to think about it that way, then those universes where the physical characteristics are more prone to form black holes will give you more daughters in the end, and those daughters will be closer to optimal for forming black holes. Yeah.
How are you defining a universe that's inside a black hole? In this particular case, what constitutes a universe?
My definition of universe is sort of unchanged, which is it's all that we can actually experience, see, smell, detect directly. So once it goes inside that black hole, we're disconnected from it. So what's happening inside that black hole, by that definition, would be a different universe in a sense.
It's basically a location or something that we're completely removed from, and that's what makes it a separate universe.
Yeah, yeah.
And there can be multiple, there can be a couple of those within a black hole that are removed from each other, making them their own universe.
Well, it can be an infinite number, yeah. Because once you accept the fact that whatever is happening inside the black hole, which I admit I'm not making warm and fuzzy for you, but if you accept the fact that what happens in there is totally disconnected from us, and that the characteristics of what happens in there could in fact be like an expanding universe, it's going to have physical constants, the space-time is going to have certain characteristics, the forces of the particles that are formed, and you can form stars which could form black holes, and then the same thing happens. So that's the picture that he has. And then one of the fun things about that is if you accept this picture, not just of the black holes within black holes, but if you accept the picture of, or universes within black holes, but if you accept this picture that the physical constants get largely transferred through this bounce, then you reach the point where in a very short time you would almost have nothing except universes in which black hole production is fairly close to optimal. So this makes very particular prediction so about what the physical constants of our universe really ought to be. And so what he says is that our physical constants may seem very finely tuned in our universe, but if we know enough about astrophysics and black holes and things like that, what we will find is that they are very close to optimal for black hole production. And this is actually a very clear, falsifiable prediction. I mean, if you were able to demonstrate that, in fact, the physical constants of our universe are very much not optimal for black hole production, which may be a hard thing to do, but if you were able to do that, then this is clearly disproven from a scientific point of view. And he likes this. He pushes this as a really great thing because I don't know of any other exceptions where there's a very clear falsifiable hypothesis that is made in the multi-universe idea. For the most part, you just sort of have to shrug and say, well, we can't get there to see it, so it's sort of academically very cool, but it's not falsifiable. Yeah?
Didn't you need an experiment to prove it was falsifiable?
Well, so I think to get there, you would have a lot of experiments, where experiments might be defined as nuclear physics experiments to understand stellar evolution, lots of theoretical work to understand how the different physical constants can affect the production of stars and black holes and things like that. So I think it's a very complicated thing, and what little I've seen, people are arguing. I don't know that we'll ever actually come to a clear statement of whether it is or isn't, but in principle, we could. Yeah?
Can you destroy universes? Like, if we created like a big bang and black holes and stuff, can they like also be weird?
Yeah, I think so. There's a scenario that I'll show you where I think they could collide and effectively this one might eat another sort of thing. Yeah. But not in all, and in some of these theories I think not. I mean, I don't, once that black hole's formed, for example, in this picture, we're disconnected. We're not going to be able to do anything to affect it, and nor it us. So, yeah.
Okay, so the picture, the circle is just everything that...
This is sort of a universe, so think of this as some starter universe. Where it came from, who knows? Okay, I'm not there yet. And you form black holes within that, and then within those black holes, you might form a universe here, which maybe doesn't happen to form black holes. This one maybe does form a few. This one maybe has physical characteristics, so it actually forms more black holes than its parent did. And within these, the characteristics are fairly similar, so each of these form a lot of black holes. So you begin to get a lot of those. So that's what he means by cosmological natural selection. Yes?
I thought you said before that it's not falsifiable.
No, it is. This one is falsifiable because it tells you that we should find ourselves in a typical universe. That's the Copernican that's the cosmological principle. I mean, we should not be in some really special universe. And from this picture, it should be that by far and away the vast bulk of the universes in the greater reality should be those that are optimal for black hole production. Therefore, we should be in one that's optimal for black hole production. And if you can prove that's not true, then this picture would fall apart. So that's falsifiable. Yes.
Wouldn't this mean that the speed of light doesn't apply in black holes? Because in our Big Bang, you said there was a period of a couple milliseconds where everything was moving faster than the speed of light.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that because I'm going to talk about inflation. But I have a friend, Lawrence Krauss, who says it this way. you can't send a signal faster than the speed of light, but space-time can do whatever the hell it wants. So space-time can actually expand faster than the speed of light, but you still have that limitation there for other things. All right. Okay, so what I'd like to do is to actually now get into the core ideas of the Big Bang. And that may help with some of these ideas and questions, but certainly not all of them. So we actually have two types of time machines, in a sense. One of them is a telescope, because the light that we currently see has been traveling at a finite speed since it was emitted, which means the further away we look, the farther back in time we're looking. And the universe is really quite big. Space actually travels very fast. So for example, one light year is 9 times 10 to the 15 meters. And I think in this week's recitation, I'm asking you to do a little bit of a calculation to sort of figure out how long it would take you to run a light year. And you're going to get an absurd number, I mean, because a light year is a really long way. Light travels between New York and San Francisco in, I'd say, 1/100 of a second. It's actually more like a 60th of a second, but not that you care. And so the universe is really big, and light has been traveling toward us for a very long time. So if we go and we look at the universe, we see lots of interesting structure and everything. So as we look out, just to get a sense of some of the scales, the nearest star, it takes 8 minutes for light to reach us from our own sun. That's 93 million miles. 4 years, roughly, for light to reach us from the nearest star. And then as we look further and further out, basically within our galaxy, we see lots of stars and gas clouds and everything. It's 1 million light years, even to the nearest galaxy. And then we see galactic clusters, so associations where they're gravitationally bound, associations of galaxies that are millions of light years across, and then the time goes on. In fact, so what I showed you was here, we see lots and lots and lots of galaxies, and it turns out that we can basically see light that comes to us from a distance of about 13.2 billion light years away. Yes?
So if we could see 13 billion light years away, can we see the Big Bang?
Just hold on to that question, because we will talk a lot about that today. We can see we can. So let's look at it. Alright, so why do we believe we live in an expanding universe? There's a guy named Edwin Hubble who, along with I think a janitor turned technician in the observatory, actually made an interesting observation. What they saw, and this isn't the original data, this is more modern data, because their original data looks a little bit less dramatic as this. But what they noticed was that if you were able to measure the recession velocity of the galaxies, and when they noticed that most galaxies, except for ones very close to us, were actually moving away from us, and then they noticed that the further away they were, the faster they were moving. And so how did they figure this out? Well, one way to determine distance is to basically look at the brightness. If I hold a candle near you and I walk twice as far away, it will be four times less bright. So if you know, and we call it standard candle, if you can actually identify something in galaxies where you know how bright it is in absolute terms, then you can look at how bright it is to your telescope and basically infer from that a distance. And it turns out that there is a particular type of supernova which supernovas basically, remember, are stars blowing up. So they get extraordinarily bright, which means you can see them from enormous distances. And that brightness doesn't last forever. It lasts a matter of days. And so the way in which that brightness turns on and then turns off is can be categorized. And there's a certain type of supernova where you can look at the way that brightness turns on and turns off and know the absolute brightness of it. So this is what we use as a standard candle to get the distances to galaxies. And then we have to get the velocity. And the way you get the velocity of the thing is to use something called spectral redshift. So there is a thing known as a Doppler shift. Which I have a nice Java applet, and I'm torn as to whether to spend the time to look for it on the web and show you, but maybe let me try it a different way. You can infer from the position of spectral lines, remember those are colors, and so for example, hydrogen emits certain spectral lines, certain colors, and if we have the hydrogen sitting in the lab, we know exactly what those colors are. It turns out that if we have that hydrogen sitting on an object that is moving away from us very fast, those colors, the whole pattern gets shifted a little bit in the red. And if it's moving toward us, it gets shifted in a little bit in the blue. And if this sounds a little Harry Potter-ish, I mean, it's actually something you're used to very much just in everyday life. If you're watching a car race or you're standing by the side of the road, you know, an interstate and cars are zipping past you, what does it sound like? Right? If the car is just right here, it's eh. But as it's coming toward you, the pitch is higher. Eh. As it moves away from you, it's lower. Eh. So it's a wave phenomenon. Light is a wave. So you have exactly the same sort of thing with light as you do with sound. And you can think of the effect in the following way. You can imagine, if you can think of the wave fronts of either the sound or the light moving outward, and it moves at a fixed speed as it goes outward. If this object is moving in this direction, you can imagine, for example, that it emitted this wave front, the one that's farthest out, when the object was sitting right here. And then it emitted this wave front when the object was sitting in the center of that circle. It's emitted this one right as it was sitting in the center of that one. And because the object is moving, the distance between these wave fronts is compressed in the direction of motion, and there's a bigger distance in the direction away from the direction of motion. So if you remember what frequency is basically the number of those wave fronts that pass a point per unit time. So if you look at if your eyeball is over here looking at the light, you're going to see these wave fronts pass you faster because they're closer together, so that would be a higher frequency or more toward the blue. And if your eye is over here, these wave fronts will seem farther apart, so they'll pass less often, and you're going to see it seem somewhat redshifted relative to the actual frequency that was emitted. So you okay with this? This is known as a Doppler shift for light. So what happens is that if this... if this is a pattern of light that's emitted, so we have a number of frequencies this way. Let me look at it this way. So here's a pattern of spectral lines that would be emitted by an atom that's at rest, and then you look at it from a moving object, you would see this pattern shifted the color of the light will actually be shifted. That's what you mean, which I haven't done on this drawing. I just wanted to keep track of the lines. But you will see the same pattern, but it gets shifted in frequency. And the degree of the shift will tell you how fast that object is going toward you or away from you. Yes?
So if you're looking at the spectral lines of an object that's, say, moving towards you, would you actually see them like moving along?
No. You would simply measure the brightness of the light coming from that source as a function of frequency, and you'll find regions where there's no light, and then you'll see the sharp spectral lines. And there'll be a specific pattern that you would recognize as being the same pattern that you have for hydrogen, but you would actually find it shifted in color by some certain amount. The degree of that
shift wouldn't be like a constant shift. It's just a shift. It's one shift just to imply that it's moving towards you.
Yeah.
It's not like moving. It's not shifting.
No, it's not moving as this object is moving, unless that object is continually accelerating or something like that. Which, if you were able to watch things over, you know, long periods of time, maybe you would see, but... Okay? All right, so this is the technique that's used to determine the velocity of galaxies, and you combine that with the knowledge of distance that you get from the supernovas, and what you find is what Hubble found, which is that these things are directly proportional to one another. So then you might ask, how does this lead to the expanding universe idea? And to get to that, let's think a moment about what you might see if we looked at a loaf of raisin bread that's rising. So you'd have raisins scattered in the raisin bread, and if you look, the raisins that are close to one another are close to one another, and those that are far apart, okay, are definitely far apart. And then as the bread rises, the raisins that are close to one another definitely move apart, but they move apart less than the raisins that are far from one another. And the reason for that is because all of the dough between the raisins is expanding, and you have more dough between the two raisins that are far apart than the ones that are close together. So if you say this is time one and this is time two, and you ask what is the velocity with which these raisins are moving apart, the raisins that started far apart moved apart more than the raisins that started close together. Therefore, they went further in the same time. That is, they're moving apart faster. And so this picture of dots in a matrix that's actually expanding fits the Hubble idea. And so this is why you infer from Hubble's data the fact that the space in the universe is expanding. Yes?
So this might sound kind of weird, noise, right? But I think it is. So basically, so we haven't really moved, it's just the distance between things has gotten bigger. I know that seems like contradictory, but...
Well, no, I mean, that's sort of the way to look at it. It's
because it's kind of a weird concept when you think of, like, the universe expanding at all, because it's kind of like it's always been a contained unit, it just suddenly got bigger.
It's the matrix itself that's swelling.
Yeah,
so if you had marbles inside some sort of stuff that was sucking up water and expanding, those marbles would all move apart in a sense. It's not as if the marbles themselves were moving, but what's between them actually expands. So that's sort of the picture. So we seem to live in this expanding universe, and so, you know, what I now want to sort of tell you. Okay, so that's one reason to believe we live in an expanding universe. So if we go back in time, then it would mean that there's a start of time, and that the universe was very hot and dense because it was very you have the same amount of energy but in a much smaller region in time. So that would be the hot Big Bang theory, which is what we're going to talk about. This happens to be the main equation, Einstein's field equations for general relativity, actually. So it mathematically, that's what it looks like. It looks pretty simple, but all these symbols actually count for a lot of indices and other equations. So it can, when you expand it, it gets nasty. Okay, so we have this weird idea that the universe, as you go back in time, had to be hot, and that basically must, in some way, something must happen so that it starts out hot and dense and then expands to become what it is that we see today. So it has very particular predictions if you think of the Big Bang model, because as you go back in time, things become hot and dense. And that means that the nature of what's going on in the space, the nature of the particles, the nature of the forces has to change. And you can maybe think about that at an early stage relatively easily. Neutral atoms are fine at temperatures like we have in our room. But if we take a gas like this and we put it in a box and we heat it up to 3,000 degrees, the energy, and remember, heat is basically kinetic energy. The atoms are bashing together to such an extent that they will knock the electrons off of one another. And as the electrons go back in, they'll cascade and emit photons. But because these photons in something that hot will actually have enough energy to ionize the atoms. So basically, at that temperature, you cannot have neutral atoms. And this has some very important effects, because what if you have a gas that is ionized, light cannot actually pass through it. It gets scattered, it gets absorbed and re-emitted. And so the universe was opaque at that stage. If we go back in time, here is today, if we go back in time to something on the order of 13.2, 13.3 billion years, the universe was much smaller and its temperature was, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 degrees, and it was opaque to light. So if you have a super telescope, to answer one of the questions we had a moment ago, if you had a super telescope and could look back in time, you can only see back to that point, because basically the universe became opaque at that point. And so if we start instead at the other side and we say, okay, something happened and the universe began to expand, and the something we'll be talking a lot about, but the universe was hot and dense and began to expand, what did we have? So at the very early stages, if it was extraordinarily high temperatures and extraordinarily hot, then what you had basically was this soup of very heavy fundamental particles. So for example, the Z particle that we talked about, which carries the force for the weak interaction, is in many ways identical to a photon, but the Z has a huge mass and the photon doesn't. And this is one of the big differences between the weak force and the electromagnetic force. But if I am in a universe where the energy is so big for typical interactions that even the mass of the Z is really small on that scale, then Zs and photons will actually look just the same to us, because the mass difference just doesn't count. So the universe at in early stages was really sort of a very different place, and the forces themselves were actually different. But can you imagine having a soup of fundamental particles early on? In fact, it was too hot for protons and neutrons to hold together. It was so hot and dense that the strong interaction, which gets stronger as the particles move apart or as it becomes cooler, was actually quite weak, which means protons and neutrons didn't exist. We believe that the universe was something called a quark-gluon plasma, which at about 1 microsecond after the start of the Big Bang, whatever that was, they would condense into protons and neutrons. Then there's a brief period, neutrons actually will naturally decay, and there was a brief period of a couple of minutes here where the neutrons, where it was dense enough that the protons and neutrons would collide and form some light nuclei, but the neutrons, the free neutrons, hadn't decayed away yet. When the neutrons get bound, they no longer decay away. But they decay away on like a 20-minute time scale. So there's only a few minutes that you have under which you can actually form some light nuclei. So you can take our understanding of how protons and neutrons interact, and you can form within a computer model basically a pot of protons and neutrons at these energies and have it cool down in the same way that the universe was cooling as it expanded, and you can calculate how many and what types of nuclei you should find, because it's a very predictable thing. And this process is called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And as we'll see, it turns out that when you go and you look at what kinds of nuclei you find in intergalactic space, you find that it fits exactly that model. These low-mass nuclei, and you have electrons and photons in here, but the universe is opaque, at about 400,000 years, maybe 300,000 years, depending on which book you're pulling the number out of, the universe cools enough that neutral atoms form. And for some reason, coming from a different area of physics, that process is called recombination, in case you run into it. At this point, the universe is almost all neutral hydrogen. There's a little bit of helium, a little bit of lithium that you can predict how much because of this process of Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And so then you start off with hydrogen, and where you have regions where there's slightly more dense hydrogen, it will collapse and form stars. You'll get star formation, and then the stars, you know, fusion will happen, and you'll go through stellar lifetime. Where you get lots of stars forming, you'll form galaxies gravitationally. So, you know, here we are today. So it's highly compressed. This is, you know, a microsecond, and I can't even read this. This is 3 minutes, 400,000 years, a billion years, you know, 15 billion, or... so that's should be about 14 billion years. So that's sort of, this is your life. Yes?
So we measure time beginning, starting at the Big Bang?
When we're looking at the Big Bang, that's how we would think of it, yeah. So that's one way of thinking of it. If you sort of say, okay, time starts. Let's set t equals zero at whatever it was that started the Big Bang. So I'm going to show you some timelines like that. We will see multiverse ideas where that, of course, makes sense only from the point of view of our universe.
So how was time measured, a second after? Like, how did, was the sun created? Or?
No. We didn't measure it. It's just if you take the size and energy of our universe and you know how fast it's expanding and you extrapolate back in time, then you can keep track of what the energy density is as a function of time, and from that understand the temperature. And because we've done lots of particle physics experiments, and because you're going up in energy in particle accelerators, you're effectively studying processes that happened earlier and earlier in the universe. So we basically, from the experiments we've done in the lab and our understanding of the nature of particle physics and stuff, we can go back in time and tell what was happening at that time as the energy density of the universe is getting greater and greater. And we can actually project back to 10 to the minus 20, maybe 10 to the minus 30-ish seconds after the Big Bang. But the fun stuff is all happening right at the start. So we're going to talk a whole lot about what's happening right at the start in a minute. So, big questions, okay? I don't know what the hell happened here. We'll talk a lot about that. From some point along in here on up, we have this idea of this expanding, cooling universe that makes very particular predictions. So let's go look at some of this stuff. So one of them is that at this stage, there was light bouncing around in the universe. The universe was opaque. There's a lot of light scattering around, and all of a sudden, the universe becomes transparent. That light that was present in that universe at that time has traveled ever since. And if we look in any direction, we actually see it. And we call it the cosmic microwave background. So a way to think about that is that our observable universe, let's assume that there was a greater reality out here, okay, and that our observable universe is 400,000 light years at 400,000 light years after the start of the Big Bang. Okay, which would be so big. So let us imagine that Earth is sitting right here, which of course Earth didn't exist at that point, but if you want to somehow think, okay, there's a point in space, and there, the observable universe around it at that time was 400,000 light years, and at that moment, the universe was totally opaque, okay? And then the universe became transparent. And if you now ask light that was emitted very, very far away, has been traveling forever, or not forever, but for a long time, and then it hits us. And that would be the cosmic microwave background. It's not really true that it was emitted from a distance of 13.2 billion light years away, because the universe is expanding. So it would be emitted from a distance that is less from us at the time it was emitted than where we would perceive it to be now. Yes?
Was this light just emitted from random stars? Or?
No. It's light that's basically glowing. Stars didn't exist at that time, right? We didn't even have nuclei at that time. We had nuclei, but we did. So what happened was it was a glowing gas where it was opaque. But it was hot. It had a lot of energy. So, for example, when we looked at the hydrogen light, that's probably the closest thing you can imagine to it, because that's a gas that ionizes and it recombines into hydrogen. But the thing is, you imagine if that gas filled this whole room and you had all this ionized hydrogen, you'd have lots of light, but I wouldn't be able to see across the room because the photons would scatter, so I couldn't get images. But if I then cooled the room down and it instantly became transparent, light that was way up by the door would then travel just fine to my eye. Okay? So, in a sense, we're sampling light that was present in the universe at that time. Yeah.
That's why outer space isn't 0 degrees Kelvin.
Yep, that's one reason, I think. I have to think whether there's a deeper reason, but certainly that's one. Yep.
Are we able to identify what direction the center of the universe is from Earth? Could you theoretically point in the direction?
Every point, the cosmological principle says no matter where you are, it all looks the same.
So isn't the theory, though, that there is something in the center of the universe around which everything is expanding? Like there's like a black hole or a big gas cloud or a star?
No, but let's keep that in mind. I mean, it is not a crazy thing to say by any stretch of the imagination. But let me get a little further down the road and then think about it, and let's talk about why that might not be the case. Okay? All right, so at 4,000 degrees, things look bright and hot. Okay, in fact, the light is, I think, I should know whether it's peaking in the UV or infrared. I mean, it has maybe a tail in the visible, but it's hot and very bright. The universe is expanding, so in all this time, as it's traveled toward us, one way to think about it is that the wavelength has gotten expanded because the space in the universe is expanding. So the color of the light has changed from when it was emitted. So in fact, we find it now in the microwaves. Another way to think about it is, because of the expanding universe, you had so much energy that is now being spread elsewhere, and I mean throughout a much bigger region, and basically it's cooled down, and it's cooled down to what would be equivalent to if I had a body at about 4 degrees Kelvin, which is almost absolute zero. It will glow. Remember, we talked about black body radiation at some point, so everything will glow, and this light that we see from the Big Bang looks like it's coming from an object right now that's at about 4 degrees Kelvin. And here is a picture of the intensity of that light, using some measure, as a function of frequency or wavelength, depending on what you want to do. And this is in the microwave region. And here are measurements. And it follows very precisely this black body spectrum that you would expect it to be. So basically, it's a picture of the early universe glowing. And it has very particular characteristics. So this is a big deal, and one of the reasons that people believe in the Big Bang. And in fact, when it was discovered in 1964, it seems to be uniform and isotropic, basically looking the same from every direction and uniform, and it yielded these two guys a 1978 Nobel Prize. It was discovered quite by accident, but it was discovered in a timely fashion in 1964, in that there were experiments being designed to actually look for it at the time at Princeton. And these two guys worked at Bell Labs and wanted to do some radio astronomy with the device that you see back behind them, which was basically an antenna that they wanted, that had been developed, I think, for an early Air Force program doing something with satellites. And they wanted to retool it and use it to do some astronomy. And so they made it much more sensitive, and they were trying to look to see if they could understand their detectors really well. And they basically kept getting a signal that they could not get rid of. And they tried everything and couldn't figure out how to get rid of the signal. I mean, they even tried scraping the bird crap off their antenna and everything. They didn't know what the problem was. And eventually, they complained about their problem to people who knew a group at Princeton that was designing an experiment to actually look for the cosmic microwave background, and they sort of put two and two together, put the groups together, and boom, it had been detected already, which I feel bad for the people at Princeton who were developing this experiment, because they effectively got scooped by these other guys for accident, and they won the Nobel Prize. You know, so it's sort of one of those funny stories in science, but it turns out that's what was discovered. So we talked about the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. There's this period as we go in time from the start of the Big Bang where the universe cools enough that protons and neutrons condense out of the quarks and gluons, and so you actually form free protons and neutrons, and then the neutrons will decay away very quickly. So within a few minutes, there are almost no neutrons left. But during that period, some of the neutrons interact with some of the protons, and you form some light nuclei. And if you were to put everything in a pot and calculate what types of nuclei you would see as a function of temperature as you cool things down, and you do it at a certain rate, so you can look at it also as a function of time, what you would see is that at early times and very high temperatures, you have mostly just protons and neutrons. So this is a factor of 10 scale. So this is 1, this is 100th, and this is 1/10,000th, and 1,000,000th. You mostly have protons, and when you go to very large times, you still mostly have protons. But the neutrons, once they're formed, they basically begin to decay away. And during a period in here, a brief period, they'll actually interact with some of the neutrons and other protons and form some other nuclear species. So this is normal helium. This is hydrogen gas. This is called tritium. Oh, this is tritium, this is helium-3, beryllium, lithium. But these are all small nuclei. But it makes notice that for most of these, as you start to go to long time, they no longer are changing. It's only in this period where they're being formed, and then they're stable. So this model makes very particular predictions as to what the ratio, say, of protons, you know, normal hydrogen, should be to helium-4, to helium-3, to beryllium-7. And when you go out and look, in fact, you see exactly these ratios. So again, it's another major experimental piece supporting the idea of this crazy Big Bang. You okay? All right. Oops. Don't want to get there yet. Okay. So here's a way of looking at the history of the universe as far as what we're talking about, and I have blacked out what's happening in the very, very early stages because that's going to be our next topic, and I don't want to start it yet, or I'll start it in a minute. But so the idea is that at this is time, okay? So here's today. Here is a few hundred thousand years, so in this case they're calling it 300,000 years. This is a few minutes. This is about a microsecond, 10 to the minus 10 seconds, and then all the way up to like 10 to the minus 35 seconds, 37, 10 to the minus 37 seconds, okay? So that's the scale. Here is the temperature. So here we are where the temperature in the universe is only a couple of Kelvin. Locally it's hotter, thank God, but you know, in the middle of intergalactic space it's quite cold. Here at 300,000 years after the Big Bang, progressing out this way, it was about 3,000 degrees. So this is the stage, for example, where as we cool down and go through that stage, we go from where we have loose nuclei and photons, these things are photons, to where we have neutral atoms and light that travels freely. Here the light is being scattered. As we get hotter and hotter, we reach a stage, here we have neutrons and stuff. Earlier, you see quarks and other types of particles, but you don't see neutrons and protons so much, etc. So this is sort of a picture of the history of the universe. This actually gives you a sense of the energies that we're able to probe. So we actually study in the laboratory energies up to this point, which is pretty cool if you think about it. All right, so just to summarize, that we observe light from the time the universe became transparent, perfect black body source in all directions, so that's this cosmic microwave background, and the ratio of the different nuclei that we see agrees with what you would expect from a Big Bang model in where that's formed in the first few minutes. Okay. All right. So one statement is these are pretty detailed, very crisp measurements that are strongly in support of the idea of the Big Bang. We know the universe is expanding. We see these ratios of the elements, and we see the cosmic microwave background. So generally speaking, physicists accept the idea of a Big Bang. I mean, more or less. We might see one model where you can concoct something that looks like the Big Bang, but it wasn't really a Big Bang. So, yeah. Was there no question? Okay. Excuse me. So there are some real big fundamental problems with the idea of the Big Bang by itself. One is that the space in the universe could have any curvature in principle. And if we go and we look at it, we find that it actually has a very particular curvature, that is, it's near flat. So we've talked about curved space a little bit. We could talk about the curvature of the space on a very large scale, and one curvature would be basically where it gets curved back in on itself, And the other might be sort of where you can think of it, you can picture a plane in terms of more of a saddle. We call it an open geometry. If we were to actually follow the implications of this, if we had nothing else involved except a bunch of matter and some space that's expanding, if the space has positive curvature, it will expand, slow down, and then come back and collapse if there's nothing else at play. If you have open curvature, it's going to expand and sort of forever. And if you have flat, it's going to expand and just come to a stop at infinite time. So it's going to slowly stop. So these are three very different histories to the universe. It turns out it's a little more complicated than that, but that's sort of the idea. At any rate, if we go out and we look at the space in the universe, and I'll tell you how we can do that next time, we find that it's very close to flat. It's basically flat space. That is a very special case. And so any cosmology that exists has to give a plausible explanation as to why the space in the universe is flat. And the Big Bang in and of itself has no reason for that. So the fact that the Big Bang does not somehow single out flat space as the preferred case is a very big problem with the whole idea of just the of a Big Bang. Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with the holographic universe?
No. Different. That's a different thing. We have the singularity problem. If you want to go back in time and you want to go back in time and you want to go back in time, whoa, what happens when everything reaches a point? And then if it's at that point, what causes the Big Bang in the first place? So there are real problems as you go all the way back. I mean, you saw that our experiments go back to a certain point, but if you keep going back, all of a sudden the densities and everything reach a point where we have no idea what's going on. So there is the so-called singularity problem. There's an idea called, there's a real problem called the horizon problem, and maybe this is the one that's most fundamental with the Big Bang. And that is, if we look at the light, the cosmic microwave background, over here, and we look at it over there, and we measure the spectrum, or if we effectively measure the temperature of the space at that point, it's exactly the same. Yet, at 400,000 years after the start of the Big Bang, this piece of the universe and this piece of the universe were further apart than 400,000 years. So they had always been causally disconnected. How in the world do they know to be at the same temperature? So in the Big Bang idea, fundamentally, in and of itself, we have a very fundamental causality problem, because the Big Bang is so uniform, we have no mechanism within that theory for the universe to have thermalized, is the way we say it. So you can take a pot of water and you can have some ice over here and, you know, some, and throw in a bunch of hot water, and you start out with very ununiform stuff, but since it's all causally connected, slowly it turns out, you know, 3 hours later you have just a bunch of water at a very particular uniform temperature. So it all works when things are causally connected. You could imagine having the universe at one temperature. But the fact is that when you look at the how things expand and how they were at 400,000 years after the start of the Big Bang, you can look at pieces that had never been in causal contact with one another, and they have the same temperature. So the Big Bang had to happen because of all this experimental evidence I was citing. And then we got some problems here that we'll go into next time that show you that the Big Bang idea has some real big issues, okay? And just to give you a little preview, we can fix all the problems with the Big Bang if we come up with a really wacky idea called inflation, which I think naively you would just never believe, except for the fact that it reconciles these big issues, and it has a lot of funny implications. So, and it plays a huge role in the ideas of the multiverse. So we're gonna get there. Anyway, okay. Have a good weekend.